It's more in their interest for us to believe that they're gods, that they're so superior to us that we have no choice, that they're doing us a favor when they do the things they do, that they come from another planet, that they come from far, far away. All these things, to me, are no different than the guy who wants to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge.
Ladies and gentlemen!
Some of these people, whoever, whatever they are, they have reached just a level of sophistication technologically where they can live wherever they want to. And they have elected, for reasons of safety, for reasons of being removed from cosmic radiation, for reasons of seeing the surface world as a resource that they can come and take whatever they want to, whenever they want to. They have removed themselves from the surface because it's more secure. They're less likely to be seen and interfered with if they're up to something that, you know, they know that we won't like. They're using us as a resource. So they've taken the logical step of basically treating us like almost like we treat animals on a preserve. People, they claim they want to find out what the truth is, but then they're completely willing to believe whatever they're told by whatever anomalous phenomena they're dealing with. It tells them something. They say, oh, okay, that must be true just because it said so.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Clearly, a lot has gone down in the world since the last time you heard from me. Specifically, for the folks who are listening in the distant future, I am talking about the Boston Marathon bombings, which happened about 2 weeks ago, and since BOA is really only a stone's throw from Boston, it was a tremendously surreal period of time, and one that continues to be surreal as the days and weeks unfold. So I had to take a brief moment to step back from the program and really just live in the moment and watch it all go down. I have a myriad of thoughts on all of this, but you are tuning in for a fresh edition of Banal of America Audio, so I will save all of that discussion and rumination for you at the end of the program. Here on this installment of BOA Audio Season 7, we are taking a journey to the underground, as we welcome author William Michael Mott for a discussion on his book Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures, which looks at the possibility that there is an entire ecosystem, including nefarious entities, existing beneath the Earth's surface. And what I think will surprise you as this gets going is how quickly we settled into a jam session style of conversation. We really connected right from the very beginning and started going down all sorts of different side roads and loosely follow the notes of the program, but really had a tremendous conversation nonetheless. Over the course of the next 2 hours or so, we are going to discuss Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures, as well as Mike's recently released treatise, The Problem of Density in Regard to Non-Human Encounters. Very heady stuff, but also very fascinating stuff. Since this ended up being more of a jam session than an interview, it's hard to really pinpoint specific big points which we discussed, but here are a handful. We're going to revisit the global historical narrative, which tells of this underground world. We'll learn about how so-called ETs may very well be homegrown entities deceiving humans, and how Bigfoot, elementals, and diminutive esoteric entities like elves and gnomes may fit into this ecosystem, as well as, of course, tons and tons more. Additionally, we are going to break the fourth wall and discuss the current state of paranormal research and how reality TV has both helped and hindered the quest to solve esoteric mysteries. Altogether, it is a fast-paced and loose edition of the program, which takes you to the very periphery of the paranormal and peers into the abyss with our guest, William Michael Mott. For those of you who are unfamiliar with William Michael Mott, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. William Michael Mott is a writer and artist who has 5 books and many magazine features in print. He's written about paranormal phenomena, comparative myth, religion, and folklore, UFOs, cryptozoology, pulp, adventure, sci-fi, and fantasy fiction, and art and education topics. He has been a guest on over 30 national and international syndicated radio programs, and currently he's one of the co-hosts at Unraveling the Secrets, which can be heard at unravelingthesecrets.com. He has also been the creative director for a national toy and manufacturing company, a software company, the art director for a city newspaper, has worked as an artist designer for Fortune 500 companies, an NSF Engineering Research Center, and for a variety of clients such as book and magazine publishers. Mike is also a freelance artist and writer, and writes both fiction and non-fiction. His artwork has been featured in various art shows, including one-man exhibits and digital galleries in various venues. He loves his kids and really, really likes books on a myriad of topics, as well as dogs and edged weapons. In addition to his illustration work and writing, he crafts handmade shillelaghs and walking sticks upon occasion. His personal website is www.mottimorphic.com. Pretty simple, but let me spell that one out for you. MOTTIMORPHIC.com. There you can find info about his writing and a gallery of his artwork can be found as well. He also has a Facebook fan page, which is linked from mottimorphic.com, and he can be reached via his website. Be sure to check it out. With all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on March 15th, 2013. William Michael Mott, talking about caverns, cauldrons, and concealed creatures on BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. And I am very excited about this edition of the program. Actually, it was spawned by a BOA Audio listener because we talked about the Hopkinsville Goblin story that came up in 2012 on our Year in Review episode. And somebody wrote in and said that we should talk to William Michael Mott because he's the man behind the book Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures. And I looked into it, and as I said on the program when I read the email, Are you kidding me? That sounds awesome. I cannot wait. I got to have this guy on the program. So now it's all come together here. He's here on the show. He's got a new, I guess you could call it a treatise out, if you will, sort of a mini book titled The Problem of Density in Regard to Non-Human Encounters. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about caverns, cauldrons, and concealed creatures and get into all this stuff that may be lurking beneath our feet. It's a very chilling book. It's a very amazingly well-researched book, and just is tremendously thorough, and I enjoyed it quite a bit, so I cannot wait to tackle this stuff with him. William Michael Mott, long time overdue here to have you on the program. I'm really excited about it. Thank you for coming on BOA Audio.
Thanks a lot for inviting me, man. I've been listening to your show off and on for years, and I'm excited to be here.
Awesome, awesome. Now, we usually start out with the bio, the background, you know, who is William Michael Mott, how did you get interested in all this esoteric stuff? And, you know, tell us a little bit about your evolution as a student of the arcane, if you will.
Well, you know, I've always been interested in this stuff. You know, starts at an early age as a reader and a writer, even as a child, you know, reading about myths and legends and of course, science fiction and all this kind of stuff. And you know, when I reached a certain point, I started exploring Fortean phenomena. I think it probably started with reading some scholastic books when I was a kid, you know, by Frank Edwards, like Strangely Enough, Stranger Than Truth, things like that, and, And then you kind of graduate from there as you get older to things like John Keel, writers like John Keel and Brad Steiger and you know, the great ones, mm-hmm. as I call them. And, you know, for the longest time, you know, I've always worked as a writer and an artist, and I would hear all these various theories out there where people were taking old phenomena, and it's being presented as new. Oh, this is just now being discovered. Look what's happening. What are these, you know, what's the possible explanation? And, you know, I knew from years and years of personal research that these things were very old and they'd always been around. There was nothing new to any of this stuff, whether you're talking about, you know, unknown humanoids or UFOs or, you know, just about any type of anomalous phenomena. It exists in the historical record and in the anecdotal record going as far back as humanity goes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I thought about it for a while and finally I decided, I guess about, 1999 or so to start writing about it. So I wrote a first edition of a book called Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures. And then that grew and it became a second edition because, you know, I wrote so many more articles and, you know, I did so much more research even after that. And so now it's in the third expanded edition, and I've changed publishers because, honestly, the first publisher was not paying me my royalties. And we had some disagreements, and, you know, I'm still having some problems with that individual. But I've got a new publisher who's got a third edition out, which is much more expansive, much less expensive, and a higher quality product. So
nice.
Yeah, people can find that. But the thing is that, you know, it's always interested me that there's this dichotomy in the human mind. I think it's a human defensive mechanism, actually, you know, that our species has, where we want to scoff at these things. We want to dismiss them out of hand. We want to ridicule people who have the guts to tell about their experiences. And that's not to say there aren't people who make things up, because there are. But there are large numbers of people who don't just make things up. They have had strange experiences. And we're not doing anybody a favor if we ridicule those people and make them scared to talk and tell what's happened to them. Because really there's nothing new to this stuff. It's all the same old stuff. And I think one of the things we need to shoot for, you know, as the human race, is to figure out a way to put an end to some of these things that go on. Because they seem to be detrimental to us. So, and they always have been. And that's just what I seem to have uncovered anyway, as I've studied this stuff.
Yeah, I noticed in the book that the term parasitic comes up a lot about these underworld entities, if you will.
Yeah.
So it certainly seems to be something that you've picked up on. I definitely agree with you. We need to reduce the giggle factor in general on this stuff, because the only, if we're going to get to the bottom of this, we have to treat it openly, honestly, and fairly.
That's right. And I think that it's a protective mechanism for the collective, you know, human psyche. There are just people who cannot deal with it. It's easier to ridicule and dismiss and make fun of and, you know, and call names and all this stuff. Because if people had to consider that some of these things might actually be real and might exist, there are people who would not be able to function. It would mess with their worldview too much. It might cause them problems with their religion, even though it shouldn't, because if they really know their religion, they'll know that all this stuff is in every religion. Mm. It talks about almost every major religion. But, you know, they find that it causes so much personal, psychological discomfort that it's easier just to deal with it, you know, whether it's as an individual or as a society, by just kind of downplaying. I mean, that's why you have, you know, leprechauns on from the cereal boxes and Bigfoot selling beef jerky, because when you minimize something like that, you basically have reduced it from being something to seriously think about and consider, to something worthy of ridicule, and it's fanciful or it's delusional, you know, and so it creates a barrier, an intellectual barrier and a psychological barrier that people feel comfortable with.
Now, at the risk of getting too deep into this concept, I guess you could say, what do you think that says about people like you and I that are that willingly embrace this this unknown?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know if you noticed this, but, you know, as you read my books, I never say, this is the way it is.
Hmm.
I say, my take is basically, it looks like this is the way it is.
Right.
Evidence indicates this is the way it is. If we study these parallels and this evidence, and we come to a logical conclusion in terms of, like, you know, Occam's razor, then this would seem to indicate that this is what's going on. In other words, you know, I don't know, but I'm trying my best to figure it out. And I don't care what anybody else thinks about that, because that's for me. Now, maybe it's weird that I would put it out there for other people to see what I'm thinking, but, you know, if you can help somebody else, if you can do something that to help somebody else realize what's going on, and they're having a hard time with something and nobody's listening to them, then it's worthwhile to write it down.
Does that make sense? Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we're sort of, I hope that someday we'll be seen as the early adopters of this stuff. So
hopefully we'll see what happens. But then, you know, we have a good tradition ahead of behind us. We have going all the way back to Fort, you know, or even further back to Reverend Robert Kirk in Scotland in the late 1600s. But we have a tradition ahead of us. People like Brad Steiger, who's still around, and John Keel and the rest, Ivan T. Sanderson, you know, that did tackle this. And it was somewhat in vogue for a while, but I think one of the things that's kind of led to the dumbing down of the field or some of these so-called reality shows about these topics, they're a quick fix with people that think they're experts, but they do little to no research, and they just want to be on television. I mean, I hate to say that, but that's the way I see it a lot of times. And so, you know, they reduce it all to the giggle factor through their television programs. I mean, you have people who are hunting ghosts or whatever they're doing, or hunting whatever they think are ghosts. They have no way of knowing what they're dealing with because they can't see it. But they're going to take the word of something they can't see that they're setting up with a question-answer section that they can't actually, you know, they can't quantify it enough to even know what they're doing. But they're going to make all these assumptions, and then the so-called investigator will run into a spider or a mouse in the dark and will absolutely freak out. Now, what happens, you know, when that investigator actually comes face to face with something truly unknown? If it ever happens on camera, I think we're going to see huge stains shooting in every direction because, you know, they make a game out of this, and it really is not a game.
Definitely not. And I agree with you there. I wonder if with the exception of the ghost hunting, which has seemed to have spawned all these amateur groups, I wonder sometimes if the crypto part of it and the UFO part of this reality boom is in a way detrimental in the sense that people get their fix on that stuff and don't actually ever go on to do the research. Do you know what I mean?
That's exactly what happens.
So we lose out on a generation of researchers who just watch the show and then they get on with their lives instead of actually putting the work in to do the research.
Well, I'll give you the perfect example. I mean, look, you know, if you read a good bit of camera, so you know, what my take is, you know, there's ample evidence that there have been previous civilizations on this planet, and there's ample evidence that those civilizations were destroyed. So I think what we're looking at possibly are the remnants, many times, of whoever those beings or people were.
Right.
And they may still be around, they just kind of lay low, for whatever their reasons are. So, you know, when you start looking at it from that point of view, and then you look at a show like Ancient Aliens, okay, where every possible thing is aliens. We don't know what it is, therefore it must be aliens.
That's right. Yep.
People were primitive back then, must be aliens. You know, people were not primitive back during the height of the Egyptian empire, the Sumerian empire, and these other things. I mean, they were building pyramids, moving blocks of stone, you know, around Baalbek in Lebanon that we cannot move today, okay, building huge platforms out of these things. I mean, we assume that antiquity means people were primitive, but people were not primitive. Everything was not done by aliens, you know. So we need to bring a critical, logical level of analysis to some of this stuff, because if we don't, what happens is it's like the person who does claim that they see something and they're just making something up, you know, or whatever. You know, you have one little bit of stuff in there that sort of really cast legitimate doubt on the topic, and to many people that's going to basically just, okay, that was bogus, therefore it's all bogus.
Right.
You know, it discredits it. It discredits the whole thing. And so we have to be very careful about how we look at these things.
That's right. The unfortunate part is that they're reaching people that aren't fellow travelers, if you will, in the unknown. They're, you know, they're reaching the lay people, who do laugh at the whole thing because it all comes off as aliens all the time. So
right, yeah, exactly, and you know they're gonna do that because that's an agenda. You know, there's an agenda there. I mean, you know as well as I do, you know, that in ufology, cryptozoology, anything anomalous, it's just like, you know, okay, this is a problem I have, like, with academia. But, look, it's not just academia. All these groups that have their belief systems, they have a lot invested in their personal theories, their personal agendas, because that's how they go to conferences, that's how they sell tickets, that's how they sell books, you know, and they're not, they look very aggressive, they have a lot of aggression toward anything that upsets their theory that they're presenting to the world.
Right.
And they're very territorial. And so that's something I try to stay away from, because I've seen an awful lot, and when I see somebody becoming really, really territorial about something anomalous, then that tells me that they probably don't know what they're talking about.
Interesting. Interesting perspective, yeah. Or they just have so much invested in it that they're not, they don't, you know, they want to be the whatever guy. They don't want anyone else getting a piece of their pie, even though.
And that's another thing that bothers me, you know, is the, in this field, is, like, if you want to call it a field, you know, the people that set themselves up as gurus of a sort, you know, and, you know, what's the point of that? That's not a search for the truth when you do that. That's a search to, that's a quest to promote yourself.
Exactly.
You know, and that bothers me.
Let's dive into your recent work first. The problem of density in regard to non-human encounters. Because having read, as you said, a good portion of Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures, I can see how that sort of grew out of CCCC.
Right.
So I guess tell people about the new piece here about density. Because I thought that was really interesting. Because, you know, you're trying to get to... It's really sort of like honing in on a particular aspect of this that I found pretty pretty intriguing.
Right, and you know, as you go further into CCCC, you'll see that there are actually areas in there that basically talk about this, but not to the depth level of this treatise. I wanted to isolate, you know, a certain perspective because I think that many of the things that we look at as, you know, supernatural, paranormal, anomalous, and all these things. And they're supposedly inexplicable, you know, they lack, you know, they just, you know, they don't seem to fit the laws of physics and these types of things. Actually, if we look at them logically, I believe they do fit the laws of physics, and they do conform to what we're learning more and more about what natural law is in terms of, you know, being on the quantum realm and on the quantum level. You know, a lot of times anomalous phenomena seem to behave as if they are quantum in nature. They almost behave like particles, but in the macro scale rather than the micro scale.
Right, right.
Yeah, they react to expectation, just like, you know, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. The electrons did in that experiment, and as photons do in similar experiments. You know, they react as if they want to respond in a way that they think you expect them to respond. Or they will exhibit properties and abilities that seem to be based more on consciousness than they do on, you know, a hard reality. But that doesn't mean they're not real. Hmm. You know, it's kind of like when Heisenberg, you know, what he discovered was that the particle in his experiment, he had a theory, and just to make it simple for people, he had a theory that he postulated, and when he ran an experiment, everything worked the way he expected it to every time while he was observing the experiment. But when he left the experiment running and he left the room, so he went to the bathroom or got a cup of coffee, I don't know what he was doing, but he left and it wasn't observed, it behaved differently, completely differently. In fact, to the opposite of what it was supposed to behave. And this was on the quantum level, so he figured out through repeatedly doing this that the act of being observed affects reality on the most basic fundamental level, the tiniest level. You know, the fact that this experiment apparently knows that it's being observed affects the outcome of the experiment. Now, this is a fact. You know, this isn't just like some paranormal theory. This is scientific fact. This is, you know, this has been proven again and again. Well, here's the thing about that, and this is where I take this one step further. Okay, once he realized that it behaved differently when it wasn't being observed. There, at that point, he expects it, even if it's on an unconscious level. His own expectation is, when I don't observe it, it's going to behave differently. Therefore, it does.
Hmm.
He reinforces it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
With his own awareness, his own consciousness, his own expectation. And I think a lot of times what we see with the paranormal, we see the same type of behavior. We see the same sort of self-reinforcement based on the expectations of the percipients and the experiencers. And, you know, I think this happens with everything from humanoids to ghosts or whatever you want to call those types of things, apparitions, to other types of strange phenomena, and even things along the lines of, I'm sure you've discussed this on your show before, you know, tulpas, you know,
right.
The thought form called a tulpa. Well, what if all this stuff, basically that's what it really is. It has its origin on the quantum level. You know, it could be consciousness, it could be consciously aware, but it's not consciousness as we know it, and it's responding to what we put out, and it's giving it back to us.
Right, right. So it's not necessarily like a sentient thing that knows it's being watched. It's just the natural reaction of whatever sort of etheric thing that's getting put out from the mind when you know you're observing it.
Right. Or even, you know, it could be to such a level that, you know, there is a ground of all being. You know, people talk about, well, obviously I'm talking about God here, creator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his expectation or God's expectation would be imprinted on reality. Okay, that's his expectation of how things are. Therefore, that's how they are because he made it. But who's to say that other expectations, other minds, if we are made in God's image, that our minds can't similarly affect reality, just not on such a huge scale. You know, you look at the idea, for instance, in Judeo-Christianity, of faith. You know, faith can affect reality. You know, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can do this and that. Well, that seems to be exactly what it's talking about. It's talking about faith in God. But still, the idea is that our expectation, if it's powerful enough, can affect reality. And so, you know, you have to wonder if there are not other minds, not our minds, not human minds, and not God's mind, but other minds out there that also have learned to play this game, and they are very good at manipulating reality using this little secret about the quantum nature of things and how, you know, consciousness affects it. And that would explain a lot about other types of beings that people report encounters with who seem to have amazing abilities. It could just be that they have learned to manipulate things on the quantum level. Things, you know, even their own density, you know, the supposed ability of many beings to pass through solid walls and become solid again. You know, they become ethereal, they pass through, and then they become solid. And, you know, or recorded instances of things that show up on, you know, night vision or even heat-sensitive equipment, and they show up as solid objects, and when people go out to check it out, it disappears. It doesn't run away. It doesn't fly away. It just disappears.
Right.
But it was there. Okay, so there could be, you know, a whole other aspect of this that does conform to the laws of nature. It's just laws that we have not discovered yet. And it's kind of like the Bugs Bunny cartoon or the Looney Tunes where somebody tells him that, you know, he's standing in the air and he says, you know, you're defying the law of gravity. He says, well, you know, I haven't studied law.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's kind of where we are here. You know, I mean, we don't quite get it because we haven't quite reached that level of understanding yet.
Well, I think that you're absolutely correct in that sense, that there's something going on that we haven't quite figured it all out. I'm not sure if it was in this piece or if it was in CCCC, where I think it was this piece where you quote someone who says, you know, we already know everything about the laws of physics, so the paranormal and supernatural can't be possible. But then you quote like a guy who was studying the speed of light in the late 1800s, and he said pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's like science always thinks that we've already figured it all out. It's like the guy who ran the patent office and said they were going to close, you know, at the turn of the 19th to 20th century because everything that could be invented has been invented by now.
Well, sure, exactly. You know, there was a guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but, you know, he said that we would never exceed the speed of 35 miles per hour because the human body just couldn't take the stress. And we would just, it would just, you know, we'd die. You know, so, you know, I think that we've got to start looking at this stuff more seriously. It's almost unfortunate that there is such a fascination on with reality television stuff about these topics, because I think it does kind of take away the gravitas of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But that's just the nature of reality TV in general. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, I hasten to ascribe any sort of agenda behind it only because I was on a show recently and kind of made the point that, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. There's 500 channels. If you look back to when, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, it was like there was 2 cooking shows. Now it's like there's 500 cooking shows and probably 2 cooking channels.
Yeah.
So it's only natural that somebody would turn to the paranormal to fill that programming void because there's only so many Honey Boo Boos you can find.
Unfortunately. Anyway, but you know, it's also true in a way of a manner of speaking. You know, I've had people say to me, "There's no such thing as bad publicity." Now, I don't necessarily agree with that on every level, but to some extent, that's true. The only thing is, you hope that people will be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. They'll be able to say, you know, well, this is bogus and this isn't. I'll give you an example. I'm not going to name any names, but I had a guest on a show recently because I do a show called Unraveling the Secrets, and it's at unravelingthesecrets.com. And this guest, very interesting person, and I guess sincere in her beliefs and stuff, but you know, she can supposedly do amazing things. She can look in your body and see your illnesses. She can, you know, look in there and, you know, tell you what's wrong with your gallbladder. And then go beyond that, she traces it to an emotional event in your life.
Oh boy.
It's not that you shouldn't have drank the paint thinner. It's that, you know, that you have some sort of anxiety or hang up about something that happened to you or somebody in your life. So, you know, I wanted to give her every benefit of the doubt. You know, I asked her about her medical training. She had none. I asked her about, you know, her, does she believe in herbs, herbal healing? No, doesn't believe in that. But she can look in your body and tell you that emotionally where you are, move her hands around and readjust your energy and all this kind of stuff. But then later in the conversation, well, she doesn't believe in channeling. She doesn't believe, well, of course, I think channeling is bogus myself. I think that, you know, if you are channeling something, it's kind of like the ghost hunter thing, you don't know who or what you're talking to. You have no way of knowing, or if it's telling you the truth, okay? Or if it's really happening like you think it is. But, you know, she doesn't believe in this and she doesn't believe in that, but she can, you know, she can tell you, she can look at your prostate and tell you why it's swollen and then narrow it down to how you resented your dog in the third grade. You know, to me, it's like, at some point people have to say, I'm looking at this so-called paranormal news. To me, this is bogus. This is not the same as the person who's sitting over here on the other side of the equation, trying to take a critical look at all this stuff and say, this makes sense based on this and based on that. And, you know, there are parallels here. In other words, we have to be selective about what we believe. And I think that some people are overly selective, and I'm talking about, like, people that call themselves critics, but all they are debunkers, because that's what they really are.
Right.
And then there are those who have absolutely no filter for being selective. They believe everything.
Yeah, they're so open-minded, their brain fell out.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of extrapolate more on the density aspect of this, because it's not just light density, it's this heavier density, and that kind of is what ties into the CCCC book, where you suggest that maybe, you know, some of these entities have the more physical ones have a stronger density because they come from underground.
Yeah, exactly. And there's evidence to support this. You know, there are many encounters where various types of anomalous beings have been fired upon. They've been struck with shovels, pickaxes, things of this nature, and the logical effect you would expect is not there. You know, they act more as if they're being inconvenienced than that they're being injured. You know, you have stories of people unloading, you know, bullets into hairy humanoids who kind of get angry and then they walk away.
Right.
And they shouldn't be walking away.
It's like an annoyance to them.
Yeah, exactly. And you have the same type of thing with, you know, some of these, everything from, you know, the original El Chupacabras in Puerto Rico, you know, who people would strike him with, one guy went out and found one of these things killing his chickens, and he took a shovel and smacked him with a shovel, and he said it was like hitting a brick wall or hitting a piece of metal. It was so hard. And, I mean, the thing grudgingly left, but, you know, he should have laid it out. And when you start looking at the evidence that surrounds this stuff, as you know from reading the book, you know, the evidence indicates that often there are areas where these types of beings are seen are very close to quick access to underground regions, whether it's a mine, a tunnel, a sewer system, a cave system, but almost always there's some sort of connection there. And, you know, this could explain how at least some of these beings disappear so quickly, because they aren't really from here anyway. They come up, they do what they got to do here in the land of plenty, and then they just go back to where they came from.
Well, it's I'm interested in knowing how you sort of, for lack of a better term, adopted the underworld, theory, if you will, because it's not exactly, it's sort of on the peripheral of all this. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It makes a lot of sense, but you don't see a lot of people championing it.
Well, you know, you look at it like this. I'm going to go take a couple of routes here, so bear with me for a minute.
Fire away, buddy. No worries.
Okay. First of all, you have every ancient tradition on our planet has a tradition of an underworld.
Uh-huh.
In ancient times, most of these ancient traditions lived in fear of the things that lived underground. Whatever you want to call them, whoever they are, various groups, they were feared. And many times they were offered sacrifices. Usually something to do with blood and flesh, and most often like the dark meats, the organs of the body, like the liver and the kidneys and the heart and things like this. This is something that was worldwide. And as our species kind of grew out of that, look, monotheism had a lot to do with this. You know, we moved away from that and we left those things in the dark. But if you look at what goes on, you'll see that many times with these types of encounters, these anomalous beings seem to be after the exact same sorts of sacrificial materials. Like when they hit the livestock, they take the blood, the liver, the kidneys, the eyes,
right,
the tongue, things like that. They don't take, you know, the whole animal or a haunch of meat. You know, they take the same sacrificial meats that used to be given to the anomalous beings. At the same time, when you look at, for instance, many UFO encounters, this is a good example. UFOs, and this has been verified, you know, they mostly are seen, if you look at the preponderance of eyewitness accounts, even the eyewitness accounts from military personnel, they're usually seen over or around bodies of water the majority of the time. Or they've been seen to come and go right into the sides of mountains, down into volcanoes, right into the ground, and then, you know, there's no explanation for it.
Right. Shouldn't physically be able to do that.
Shouldn't physically be able to do that, unless, of course, they can alter their density.
Exactly.
And, you know, Ivan T. Sanderson wrote a book back in 69, I think, called Invisible Resonance. And his whole postulation was that some of this stuff, a lot of these things are coming from under the ocean, and we share our planet with a civilization that's sub-oceanic. And that makes a lot of sense, but see, I didn't read that book until after I'd written mine. And I have some of the sub-oceanic stuff in there too, but I believe that we have an aspect of our biosphere here that we just don't see that often because it's inhospitable to us. And for whatever reasons, some of these people have, and I'll call them people, some of these people, whoever, whatever they are, they have reached a level of sophistication technologically. A long time ago, they had their singularity event, okay? So they've reached a point of development where they can live wherever they want to. And they have elected, for reasons of safety, for reasons of being removed from cosmic radiation, for reasons of seeing the surface world as a resource that they can come and take whatever they want to whenever they want to. They have removed themselves from the surface because it's more secure. They're less likely to be seen and interfered with if they're up to something that, you know, they know that we won't like. If they're using us as a resource.
Yeah.
And so. So they've taken the logical step of basically treating us like almost like we treat animals on a preserve.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard it supposed in places that maybe to, I wouldn't say retreat, but to live in within the interior of a planet might actually be the more intelligent sort of tact to take. That's why we don't, you know, we don't see any cities or anything like on Mars or any of these other planets or anything, because maybe if there are, you know, intelligent entities, maybe they figured out that the smartest place to be is, you know, under the surface. So if you get hit by an asteroid or, you know, weather and that kind of stuff, you're not really affected by it.
Well, you know, we know that asteroids hit this planet. I mean, we know it's a fact, and we know that something was so catastrophic that it basically, it didn't happen immediately, but it led to the demise of, you know, an entire ecosystem that existed here, not once, but at least a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if there were civilization, okay, look, the so-called age of the dinosaurs, it lasted for hundreds of millions of years. Human beings have been around for about a million years. Modern, or humans as we think of humans, even pre-modern humans. So, let us suppose, as a thought exercise, that you know, during the age of the dinosaurs, and many dinosaurs, by the way, were warm-blooded, they were endothermic, just like birds are.
Mm-hmm.
So let us suppose that there was a civilization that had developed over hundreds of millions of years, and then a cataclysm strikes the planet. The survivors may very well decide, we don't want to go through that again, let's go underground.
Right.
And they've been there ever since. And the same sort of thing we see, first is on Mars, you know, obviously Mars at one point had an atmosphere and an ecosystem, and they're now dancing around the idea, well, maybe it can support life even now, you know. They know something they don't want the rest of us to know, but you know, obviously there was running water, there were oceans, all this type of stuff, but something happened that was so devastating to the surface, it literally sucked the atmosphere off, at least for a while. And bombarded the surface with, you know, with fragments of huge rock fragments. Something cataclysmic occurred, you know, possibly the explosion of another planet between Mars and Jupiter, which left the asteroid belt. But like you said, if there were a civilization there, and if there were any survivors, they would have two options, and both of which they might elect, you know, to follow. One of which is to come here in antiquity, and the other of which is to go underground. To survive.
Right.
To me, it's logical that what we're dealing with is not from Alpha Centauri. I'm talking about UFOs specifically right mm-hmm. now. You know, it's not from Zeta Reticuli. You know, if you were, hypothetically, let us say that you were a not a nice person and you decided you were going to take advantage of some neighbors that you had. They were much more primitive than you were. And you actually live right on the other side of the mountain. But these neighbors look at you as some kind of god. So you're going over there and you're coming in the middle of the night taking their maidens for experiments or impregnation or whatever it is you're doing. And which we would call rape, by the way.
Obviously, yeah.
And kidnapping.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're coming over there and you've got these people hoodwinked to thinking you're some kind of god, you're doing something special for them. And they say, well, where are you from? Are you going to say, oh, I'm from the other side of the mountain?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. You're going to say, oh, look, up there, you see that star up there? That's where we're from.
Yeah, don't bother even trying to get there to get us. So,
yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's the same old story. I mean, and what amazes me, it's the same thing with channeling or any of this, you know, this ghost hunting stuff or whatever. People, they claim they want to find out what the truth is. But then they're completely willing to believe whatever they're told by whatever anomalous phenomena they're dealing with. It tells them something. They say, oh, okay, that must be true because it said so. You know?
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's a very good point. And, you know, just to speak to the, you know, you make the point continuously in the book, and I think you made it earlier in the conversation. I know you did. And that's just that. Whatever these things are, even beyond where they come from, they definitely, I think, see the human race as the way we see animals, almost. I think that's almost, having looked at this for so long, I think that's almost I wouldn't go so far as to say a given, but damn near close.
Well, you know, it's almost like there's a level of contempt involved here. It's a contempt based on a resentment because they need what we have.
Right.
In other words, there's something we have genetically, there's something we have spiritually, there's something we have on several levels that they do not have, but they desperately want. Maybe every now and then they need an influx of genetic material. And they look at us as inferior, but they're actually the ones who are inferior.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, they're the ones that are, they have the weakness and they need us.
Right, exactly. But they don't want us to know that. You know, that it's very, very important to them that we not figure that out. The thing about this whole phenomenon, I'll give you a perfect example. If these beings were from the other side of the galaxy, mm-hmm. or even another star system, and they had discovered how to very quickly travel between interstellar distances, between star systems,
right,
safely and quickly, and they find themselves at a genetic bottleneck or with a major genetic problem, why would they come all the way to this little planet out on the edge of the galaxy to get what they need? Because if they're that advanced, they would already be able to design their own DNA, correct genetic problems, rebuild themselves completely, correct any problem that they've got. We're making huge advances ourselves, you know, in genetics.
Right, right.
So imagine what they supposedly would be able to do if they were a million years ahead of us, or even 500 years ahead of us. Okay? So, you know, this whole idea of, well, we've had to come all this way because, you know, the Earth people have what we need. No, whatever these things are, they're from here too. Because genetically, they would have to be related to us in order to interbreed or use our genetic material. Secondary to that, if they need what we have genetically, why wouldn't they just ask us outright unless they were scared we would put an end to it? Or we would want something in return?
Yeah. It makes you wonder you say they look at us with contempt and, you know,
right.
not to empathize with their point of view, but if you could, it sounds kind of like, you know, let's say the house you grew up in, you got to move away. And isn't there always sort of a little bit of a odd feeling about the family that moves into your old home? You know, maybe it's something like that. They're sort of like, listen, we were here first.
Right.
You know.
Well, I'll give you an example.
And so that's their kind of perspective on things. They own this planet. We're just, you know, hanging around right now at the time. But they're in their mind, it's kind of like the farmer owns the farm. The cows don't.
Well, it could be that they see it that way, but that's not the way it is. It could be that they had a lease and their lease is up, which many ancient traditions seem to indicate. Many major religions seem to indicate that. But they don't want to go. You know, they don't want to, you know, say, okay, we're done.
They're like squatters.
Yeah, like squatters. And they're very sneaky in about the way they do things. You know, and it always amazes me, all these people with all this benevolent space brother bull crap, you know, benevolent space brothers, they're here to help us. We should join the galactic community. Okay, you're going to join something. You don't even know what it is. You don't really know if there is a galactic community, even if they say that's where they're from. You see what I'm saying here?
No, absolutely, yeah.
And when these things, you know, you read all the literature, all of it, you know, pretty much, you know, these beings come. Okay, supposedly they're telepathic. Supposedly they're advanced. Okay, if they're so advanced and they're telepathic, why don't they just come and just, like, leave you asleep and, you know, use like a damping EM field or something and just make sure you stay asleep and take what they need and leave and you never know they're there. No, they don't do that. They come in and they make a big drama. They terrify people. They seem to relish, you know, when they put you through supposedly painful processes that are basically almost like torture sessions. You know, there's quite a bit of S&M involved here with what they're doing, or at least sadism.
Yeah.
You know, they seem to really get off on it. They enjoy it because they look at you and they supposedly see what's in your mind and they know what you're doing and they tell you, don't be frightened. We're, you know, okay, you don't want me frightened. First of all, don't do this. Second of all, leave me asleep when you do it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, there's something here that's inherently akin to rape and terrorism, I guess, for lack of a better term.
So what would you ascribe that ill will to? Why do you think, you know, why can't they do, why, you know, in the immortal words of Rodney King, why can't we all just get along? Why can't they, are they actually afraid of us, you think, or you know?
I think there's a little bit of all of it. I thought you were going to say Rodney Dangerfield, you know.
Well, it's clear we don't get no respect from these entities, no matter what.
We don't get no respect. No respect at all. No, but, yeah. But yeah, you know, the thing about this is that I think that this is based on resentment, and they resent that they need what we have.
Mm.
They don't have any other choice. You know, personally, I think that if it weren't for the fact that they need what we have, various things that we do for them. You know, even on a spiritual level, things that they purloin from human beings. If they didn't have that need, then we might not still be here.
Yeah. That certainly seems the case. I mean, that goes back to the why don't they just wipe us out theory on aliens. So.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, you've traced this back so far, though. I guess the question is, they haven't been able to figure out how to fix their need to the point where now we're talking like thousands of years here that they've been looking for the genetic material. They keep needing the genetic material here for thousands and thousands of years.
And that just indicates that they're not as advanced as, say, an interstellar society would be.
Right, because they're not figuring this, you know, they should be able to figure it out by now.
Exactly.
So it doesn't make any sense.
And this ties back to legends that, you know, exist all around the world, again, where, you know, as you probably saw in CCCC about, you know, ancient civilizations of beings, whether they're called the Dragon Kings or the Naga or the Nephilim or whatever you want to call these beings, they were part human and part something else. And one of the drawbacks to that is that once they make that, once that hybridization occurred, if they don't get a regular influx of human genetic material, then they become less and less human themselves in appearance.
Huh.
They degenerate. And so, you know, they have to periodically have a fresh influx of, you know, it's just like any genetic bottleneck. I mean, you have a group of people that are highly isolated and they start inbreeding and they inbreed for generations and generations. All kinds of weird stuff starts happening to them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they get flippers and everything else. So, you know, these beings, we may not even be, they may be related to us, but they're not us. If they've hybridized with us, they're going to find themselves needing new genetic material more and more frequently as time goes by.
We're not even really going to get, I have a feeling, just based on where we're at so far in the conversation, we're not really going to get into the hardcore specifics of the book because we're really exploring some of these big themes. And I'm loving it, so don't
right.
So don't take it the wrong way. So I'm going to keep going in that vein. But you pick out my favorite guy here in the world of the paranormal, that's Bigfoot. And you suggest that he's not paranormal, he's not natural in the sense that he's a creature like a bear or a deer that's just living somewhere we can't find him, but that he is part of the underworld ecosystem.
Right. And, you know, there are several things that could be going on. And again, this goes for anything we've been talking about. I mean, you could have things that are superficially the same in terms of the way they appear, where they present themselves, but you could be dealing with five different things.
Right.
Okay. So you could be dealing with John Keel's what did he call them? Big hairy monsters, BHMs. You could be dealing with those types of beings, which are, you know, wholly paranormal, or as I would say, they're quantum in nature. Okay, they're basically tulpa forms, and they may even be able to manipulate reality based on, you know, consciously manipulate reality based on our expectations.
Right, they can change the way they appear based on the witness.
Right, and then you may have a whole other thing that's going on that is completely a natural creature. Or is it by natural? I just mean it's physically real.
Right, right. It's like an actual animal or whatever.
Right. Or, you know, something that's part of this ecosystem, part of another ecosystem that we don't see very much.
Hmm.
And there seems to be, you know, there's so many stories about Bigfoot living in caves, coming from tunnels, coming out of mines, going into, you know, even train tunnels, all this kind of stuff. A lot of sunken areas like sumps. I don't know if people, your listeners know what a sump is. But like a sinkhole area that's been there for a long, long time, and it's got caves connected to it. You know, there are lots of Bigfoot encounters that take place around these areas. At the same time, though, you know, you have this recent uproar, and I don't know what you think about this, but the supposed genetic material that they found with the Bigfoot being part human. Have you heard about that?
I've heard about it. I try not to think about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, let us assume that is accurate, that they have actually found something. First of all, it's going to run into the same territorial resentment and opposition that I talked about earlier.
Right.
Among those who, if that doesn't fit their paradigm, that they're pushing for their own self-aggrandizement, you know, because they're not interested in the truth, they're just interested in being right, okay, then they're going to push back real hard against something like that. But if you consider for even a moment that what the woman has found, Dr. Ketchum has found, is true, and that there is a Bigfoot DNA that's legitimate are several samples that is part human, that is part unknown primate, and then she said novel life forms that we can't even identify.
Right.
Then right here we're talking about hybridization, and at some point that hybridization had to be initiated. Maybe it was initiated in a lab a long, long time ago. But again, you know, you tie this in with, like, for instance, David Paulides' research about, he talks about missing 411,
uh-huh.
but where he basically dances, he's talking about all the thousands of people that have disappeared over the years in and around national parks, inexplicably just vanish, and he sees patterns. Now, he doesn't come out and say it in the book, but his basic premise is that they're being kidnapped for breeding by somebody or something.
Right, right. And you so, point out in the book the sheer number of amazing number of disappearances. I think you quote a stat there that was from 1998, there was something like 2,200 people go missing a day?
Yeah, yeah, and that was from 98.
Right,
now,
right.
A lot of those people are found. A lot of them are changing their identity. Some of them are runaways. But even once you factor all that in, this still leaves this huge number of people that just absolutely, in the United States alone, vanish every year.
Right.
With no trace.
Even if,
no
even if 10% of the 2,200 that disappear a day don't come back, you're still talking about a massive number.
Right. And that's 1998 numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you start looking at the rest of the planet, the so-called third world, and, you know, places like, you know, Eastern Europe and other places where people disappear, you know, some people are kidnapped for the sex trade. Some people are kidnapped for, you know, nefarious purposes and this and that. But the numbers are still so huge that we're talking about what almost looks like a culling of a herd or a harvest of a crop on a regular basis.
Right.
It's very disturbing. But see, again, if these types of these numbers were occurring because of a product defect, you know, in the marketplace, or because of a war, the outcry in the media, the news media, and the outcry, you know, in the everyday life, people's protest would just be deafening. I mean, it would not stand.
Right.
Okay. But, you know, a blind eye is turned to this
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Well, now that raises an interesting point, and I didn't see really any discussion of this in CCCC. But in light of, you know, the advancements of ground penetrating radar and you know all the theories of government dealings with aliens, and regardless of where their origins and all that stuff, we're just going to use aliens as the catch-all here.
Okay.
I mean, what do you think of? I guess, what do you think the government knows about this underground ecosystem?
I think they know about it. If you go further into the book, I know you haven't finished it yet. You'll see some indications that they do know. But what can they do? You know, first of all, you want to start a war with these whoever these beings are? I don't think so, because they live in this on the same planet we do. I mean, we don't want to destroy our planet trying to get rid of these termites, because that's the way I look at them.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, there's all this talk in the UFO community about how they're here to help us. They want to protect us from our nuclear weapons. No, they want to protect themselves because they live here.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, it's interesting that the first major sighting by Kenneth Arnold occurred just very shortly after our first underground nuclear test.
Well, I guess the part of this, I have this in the notes, is that you say, you know, well, do you think they really want to go to war with these people? I almost think that maybe that's a foregone conclusion. If this is all, if this all stacks up the way you think it does, or you're,
well,
or the,
you know,
it seems, you know, we're eventually going to ruin the surface of the earth and have to go underground. We're going to run into them when we get down there, I think.
Well, supposedly we've run into them already. You know, there are lots of stories about underground battles with so-called alien bases and things like this. But they're probably not from somewhere else. They're probably from here, and they always have been.
Hmm.
You know, when you start talking about things like war, well, who's to say that, you know, the various theories that people have about, you know, I know, for instance, if you look in the book of Ephesians in the Bible, you know, it talks about the levels of demonic or, you know, evil opposition, and it talks about spiritual wickedness in high places, principalities and powers. Okay, those would be like fallen angels. But then it says, in the rulers of the spiritual darkness of this world. Well, you know, in ancient Hebrew tradition, there were a group of fallen angels, and what they call fallen angels. And, you know, one man's fallen angel is another person's, you know, advanced being from antiquity, whatever.
Exactly.
But the thing is, it talks about how they had hybridized with humans, and as a punishment, their offspring were destroyed in a cataclysm, which was later recorded as the Great Flood, and the whole civilization was wiped out. Of course, now we're finding huge ruins on the bottom of all the oceans, including even down around Cuba, you know, where there is something there that was destroyed. But basically, when you look at that ancient tradition, it says that the beings that did that, as their punishment, the Book of Jasher, the Book of Jubilees, all these various apocryphal books, the books of Enoch, all the versions, they're talking about these beings being driven underground. They're sealed underground. They said, this is where you live now. You don't come out here with the rest of us. This is your punishment. Well, you know, who knows what kind of a memory that is of something that might have happened. Now, you take that to the next step, which is where you have people, and look, this is not my belief, okay, but you know, they talk about bloodlines that are ruled by these different beings that are influencing human civilization. Well, you know, you look at, for instance, if you go look in the traditions of the Hindus, you'll find that the Nagas and the Asutras and these other subterranean humanoid beings influence who's going to be the king, who's going to be the queen. They intermarry with people. They kidnap people for genetic crossbreeding. You know, you go to Northern Europe, you find the same things. You know, the whole frog princess thing or frog prince thing actually is the whole idea of this non-human being who lives underground in a well. And, you know, he coerces this girl. At first he's unattracted to her, but eventually when she comes around to his way of thinking, you know, then she gets all these benefits because, you know, she becomes his bride.
Right.
And you have the same thing everywhere. It's in Japan. It's in China. It's in Native American folklore. It's everywhere. And so, you know, you have to wonder if there are, you know, there are many, well, I know that there are cults that claim to communicate with non-human beings that live inside the earth and things of this nature. And inevitably, of course, they're very secretive and they tend to do things which would not make them popular in society. Okay? I just put it that way. So, you know, it could be that these things go on. And so, you know, how are you going to go to war against them when they have basically could well have infiltrated our society at various levels and to an unknown extent that we don't even know how much we've been compromised over
right.
time.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Well, you know, you look at, for instance, Napoleon. You know, Napoleon claimed that he met with someone called the Red Man, and this little guy was seen. He would appear in Napoleon's chambers, and the guards would not be able to stop him, and they would confer, and then he would disappear. And then again later with Adolf Hitler, the same thing happened, except they had a guy that they called the Tibetan because of the way he looked, and this guy would appear in Hitler's chambers and have long talks with him, and then he would disappear. And absolutely freaked out, you know, the guards and stuff, because they had no explanation for how this was going on. And, you know, at one point Hitler said, I have seen the new man. He is intrepid and cruel. I was afraid of him. So, was he talking about this mysterious being that he was, you know, conferring with periodically? Or had he been told something by this being? You know, obviously he was being manipulated.
Right.
Many leaders down through history have had these types of encounters where they're manipulated. You know, a perfect example is Alexander the Great. You know, Alexander the Great was told he was the son of a god, whether he was or not. What they call, like I said, they live on the other side of the mountain, so they're going to tell you they're gods.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess I'm trying to look at the whole, pull the camera back a little bit here on the whole ecosystem of the universe. Now, do you think then that out of hand, there's no. Because I feel, because I've always sort of been of the belief that there had to be aliens coming here, regardless of I don't think all UFOs are aliens, but I think there has to be some just passing through. I mean, do you think that's a possibility or because
it's no different than what we talked about earlier with the hairy humanoids. I mean, there could be five different explanations for these things,
right?
But and they just superficially appear to be the same thing. But I think that you know. In my opinion, as near as the human mind can grasp, the universe is infinite. Logic would tell us that in an infinite universe, anything you can imagine at some point somewhere is going to come to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the laws of probability. Okay? You add to that the probability of habitable planets and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, you're going to have a universe that's teeming with life, just as you have a puddle of water that's teeming with life.
Right.
Does that mean that they get here? No, it doesn't. You know, and if they do, why would they come here? If the universe is teeming with life, what do we have that they can't find somewhere else much nearer to home?
Who knows? You know
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But could be something as simple
as cats, you know. Yeah, who knows what they need?
Yeah, no. Handy wipes.
What's that?
Cigarettes. Handy wipes or cigarettes.
Exactly, Jack Daniels. I'd travel across the universe for that.
Fortunately, you don't have to go that far.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, I'm just trying to sort of wrap my mind around the overarching ecosystem of this. I think the end takeaway from a lot of this, though, is that it's something that was obvious, I guess, in general, but your book sort of drives it home that we're really not. It's like goes to the Copernicus thing. Not only does the sun not revolve around the earth, but the human race is not the be all and end all of all this.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you think about it, if you look at it logically, you know, it really does go back to what William of Ockham said, what we now call Ockham's Razor. And, you know, the funny thing about Ockham's Razor is people, you know, you'll hear Carl Sagan quote, you know, William of Ockham, you know, and people nowadays, like Skeptical Inquirer people, William of Ockham's Razor, they don't have a clue about what Ockham's Razor, because they misrepresent what it says all the time. And what they don't tell you is William of Ockham was a theologian. And he was trying to answer a theological argument about the existence of God when he came up with his so-called postulate, you know, about, you know, but that doesn't come out now because it's people who do not want to, you know, suppose the existence of God who use Occam's razor to try to make their point. But the point, I think it is a very logical way of looking at things, and it is that, you know, no matter how absurd it might seem at first when you're trying to find an explanation, after you've exhausted most things, you will find that the simplest explanation is usually the correct answer.
Right.
Even, you know, it's just like years ago they had all these ideas about what caused disease, you know. And, you know, and they had all these crazy ideas, and then somebody said, well, you know, maybe it's like these little tiny animals that we can't see. Oh, no, that's ridiculous. It can't, you know, but what did it end up being? The most logical, obvious answer. Or the idea of spontaneous generation, where they decided that, you know, that raw meat would spontaneously turn into maggots and flies, you know.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I've used that example just in general with the paranormal, where it's like, you know, anyone who dismisses, for example, your work here on the underground ecosystem, anyone who dismisses out of hand the possibility, you know, well, there was already this whole ecosystem we didn't know about, which was germs. So it's entirely possible there could be a whole underground ecosystem.
Well, not just that, but, I mean, I've been kind of sort of watching for a few years now. Every year they discover new underground life forms, and I'm not just talking about germs. You know, a new hairy crawdad critter or something that lives, you know, underneath Britain, and new animals here and there that live in caves. And these are larger animals, larger organisms. And they get like a brief mention in some little quirky news feed, and then they're gone. You know, you don't hear about it again. But, you know, large animals are discovered all the time anyway. They just don't tell you that because they're so concerned with pushing the idea that everything's dying that they don't want to tell you that new life forms are being found all the time. So, you know, it's and that's another thing we have to look at. There are always agendas, you know, in news feeds and in news in general. Anything that we're told, there's an agenda. There's always a correct way to think, and there's an incorrect way to think, and you dare not step outside of the correct way. You know, as you can tell, I'm majorly against political correctness in general. So, you know, I think that anything that stifles individual thought is dangerous. And, new life forms are found all the time, and many of them are subterranean, every year, as a matter of fact.
When the Sox and Celtics and Patriots or Bruins are champions again, to the chagrin of New York and Chicago fans, the crowds will gather and watch a parade go down Boylston Street. And this time next year, on the third Monday in April, the world will return to this great American city to run harder than ever and to cheer even louder for the 118th Boston Marathon. Bet on it.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
This is our fucking city. And nobody gonna dictate our freedom. Stay strong. Thank you.